Welcome to the Agency in Focus SOCOM, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Special Operations Forces community is a small one relative to the rest of the military. But it's tight, and in one sense, no one ever leaves. Numerous former special operators work in supporting foundations devoted to the care and betterment of SOF, or Special Operations Forces. One is the Global SOF Foundation, founded by Stu Braden. During the recent SOF conference in Tampa near SOF headquarters, I spoke with Braden, president and CEO of the foundation. We started with what the Global SOF Foundation is all about.
We're 4 years old this week. We just celebrated our fourth anniversary. We're a professional association for special operations. We're a 501c3 nonprofit that basically advocates for special operations globally. We've got about, we're getting close to 2,000 individual members. And from, I think it's like 64 countries. It's got around 74 corporate partners. We're doing well. We're out there helping the community do what it needs to do to be a relevant part of global security.
And to advocate on behalf of special operations, where do you have to do that besides Congress?
You do a lot of it's education. You know, we're an educational nonprofit, so you have a lot of young staffers in any parliament or any Congress, and so you've got to focus on making sure they understand everything so they can present that to their principals in a coherent manner. So you spend there's a lot of turnover in those folks because they're young people, and they're there a year, maybe 2 years, and they're gone. So it's a never-ending piece. We do that in a lot of countries. A lot of ministers of defense and, people inside the MODs, they're not really familiar with special operations. You know, they come from the private sector and have no military background whatsoever. A lot of them are very leery of their own people. You know, they're not so trusting, depending on what country we're talking about. So, having a group of Americans from a nonprofit that can talk to them with no strings attached has been reasonably effective so far.
Yeah, and I guess special operations people from different nations have more in common almost with one another, I imagine, than sometimes they do with their own countries.
Yeah, we're all from the same DNA. I mean, the reality is we all came out of the OSCE in World War II, which was the British, equivalent to the OSS. We stood up the OSS. The Rangers were stood up in Scotland with the commandos. And so, the reality is we all come from that DNA. The French were there. The Norwegians were there. The Danes were there. And then, post-World War II, it started to proliferate to some degree because of the operational environments we were in these little small wars from Malaysia to Vietnam to, throughout Indochina and stuff like that. So we've kind of grown together. We know each other, and so it's more of a fraternal organization than it is like anything else you would ever see.
I guess in one sense, you never really leave.
No, SOF for life.
And what is your own background in SOF?
I retired from U.S. SOCOM in May of 2014, so 4 years ago this month. Actually, yesterday, 4 years ago yesterday, I retired from the military with about 32 years of service. Let's see, a little over 28 of that was in the special operations community. I looked at doing a lot of things, leaving the community, and I get some great job offers from wonderful companies and stuff, but I'd been kind of spoiled. I spent the last 9 years of my life working directly for a 4-star or 3-star, and so I'd had a lot of autonomy, and I just was coerced into building a professional association for special operations. Didn't really know what a 501c3 was, and we just started with an idea, and here we are 4 years later.
All right, let's talk about special operations themselves a little bit. And the last couple of National Defense Authorization Acts changed the approach in some ways to what they call at the Pentagon SOLIC, Special Operations in Low Intensity Conflict. And a lot of that's changing the way it's reporting in the Pentagon. What's your assessment of what they're doing?
So if I understand what it's, we do an event every year in Washington around the middle of November. And last year we had both Representative Thornberry and Representative Smith in the first panel, and this was specifically brought up.
Keep going.
But I think what you're I think what you're seeing is an evolutionary thing and not something that's really a major deal. If you go back to when, you know, Cohen-Nunn Amendment formed U.S. Special Operations in 1987, I mean, there was a move afoot to make it a separate service. And the compromise with the service chiefs and everybody was to form U.S. SOCOM and give it, you know, Major Force Programming MFP 11 money so it could do its thing. They envisioned them doing, they gave U.S. SOCOM service-like authorities at the time. But, you know, over the last 30 years, they really don't, you know, they don't have all of the service-like authorities they need to do the things they need. And so U.S. Congress took it upon them. You know, SOCOM is the only four-star congressionally mandated headquarters in the history of the Department of Defense. Without Congress, they would never exist. I even believe to this day the services would have resisted it just because it's different and nobody wants to give up control of anything. I think it's good what they're doing. I mean, what they're really, I mean, if you listen to Rep. Thornberry and Smith, is, I mean, it's very clear they want to make ASD Solik more service-like. They want him to pick up more of the roles and functions that the services are doing. And so I think it's going to be change. We in the foundation have been advocating for the last 3 years that the Assistant Secretary of Defense position for Special Operations be upgraded to an undersecretary position.
Right. That's one of your specific recommendations in the foundation's latest paper. And
it's been out for 3 years, so we've had it in the last three. And so we think it's really important to make that move. I think there's momentum behind that. You know, the first step is getting all the administrative side lined up behind them. Becoming a service or having more service-like capability isn't easy.
I mean, well, could that also weigh it down too much, and then it doesn't have the agility that it needs for a lot of functions?
If you listen to what they're saying, what they want to do is take a lot of the administrative burden off U.S. SOCOM and purely allow them to focus on operations. And that's what the legislation proposed. That may not be what reality is, but that's the going-in position that they want. And, you know, anything that you can do to alleviate administrative burdens on the force is a good thing. That's not a bad thing.
Sure.
And it would be, you know, it's not good to be in ASD Solik because you're going to get more work. But if it actually does take work off the plate of U.S. SOCOM administratively, then I only see that as a good thing, not as a bad thing.
You're listening to an interview with Stu Braden, President and CEO of the Global Soft Foundation. More after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
Welcome back to our interview with Stu Braden, President and CEO of the Global SOF Foundation, Special Operations Forces. The discussion took place during this week's SOF conference in Tampa, Florida. In this segment, we discuss the Foundation's most recent set of recommendations called the SOF Imperatives.
You know, I tell everybody, our 9/11 started 30 years ago. And so, you know, we were at a breakneck pace long before the towers fell. We just were thrown into more deep combat operations at that time. So, I mean, the op tempo in the special ops community has been really, really, really high for the last 30 years. Every day I was in it, you know. Just kind of give you some background. When we do the SOF imperatives document that we put out every year, you know, it's not us just sitting around making stuff up. We actually send out a survey to active duty folks that are actually members of the foundation. We solicit their input. You know, none of this is classified. We're just kind of trying to get ideas and thoughts and stuff to see where the community's going. We get a lot of input from a lot of people out there. We sort through it, and, you know, we have a process of determining, you know, how much, based on the results of the survey, what goes forward and stuff.
And by the way, we should point out that as we speak, we are in Tampa, Florida, during the annual SOFIC conference, and there is practice drills going on outside the room. That's
mini
what's guns, going on in the background.
Miniguns and 50 cals right
but
now.
Stu and I are here safely inside, inside the building. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's miniguns and 50 cals. It's not like a chainsaw out there, but yeah. But yeah, I mean, we've got recommendations. Most of this comes inside the community. No, I don't think any of it's rocket science. I mean, I don't think anything on this paper surprises anyone in U.S. SOCOM headquarters. It shouldn't. I see this as just another mechanism for us to advocate to Capitol Hill. You know, we're not in government, so I don't have to just respond, you know, I support the president's budget. You know, we as an organization, you know, we want to do what's right for the community, period, all stop. And so we challenge things. You know, we're not always in agreement with everybody out there, but, you know, we want to, our hearts are pure and our intent is to, you know, do the right thing. We look wider than just the U.S. Special Operations. You know, we have global partners, and so a lot of the recommendations and things we talk about are dealing with security cooperation as well.
Well, let's get to, again, back to the training and readiness question. I just want to focus on one area, and that is care and feeding, if you will, of the families of special operators, because if the operators themselves are under this high tempo and high pace that doesn't seem to have any end in sight, then there is a lot of pressure back home that can maybe be alleviated by some measures the Pentagon could take.
Yeah, so, you know, all of this started when Admiral Olson was the SOCOM commander. He did a pretty extensive survey that went out to the force, to include the families. And you know, we're kind of a weird tribe, you know, because most of the operators are, you know, they want to be in this, right? So they leave the conventional force or join to do these things. They're not looking for a break. No one joins Special Ops going, wow, I can, you know, take a day off. And that's not how it works. It's actually the opposite. The problem is that, you know, we assess and select these people and, you know, for their drive, determination, and they'll self-destruct if you let them. I mean, that's what we want on the team. The problem is as the leaders, they've got to regulate that, and it ain't easy. I won't lie to you. It's a very, very tough, challenging thing, because you're telling someone that, you know, basically sold their soul to be in the special ops community, that they can't do the very thing that they wanted to do. Most of the impact in the survey during Admiral Olson's tenure, it came back, and really what it said was, you know, and I'm kind of paraphrasing it, but the operators were fine. You know, they're saying, hey, take care of my family. You know, I signed up for this. They didn't. And so when Admiral McRaven took over for Admiral Olson as the SOCOM commander, he set up the preservation of the force and family operational planning team. And the focus of that was just to figure out, you know, at that point in time, all of the components were doing little things to try to, you know, help their force. And what Admiral McRaven wanted to do is bring it all under one umbrella, institute best practices, and to be frank, he wanted to do a heck of a lot more than they were currently doing. And he wanted to make sure that, the number one thing was the people, and he was dead serious about it. Throughout the entire thing, the biggest concern to the families was predictability. They understood that the spouse would be gone. They understood the sacrifices and everything they were making. What really bothered them was the predictability of knowing when they were going to be gone and when they were going to be back.
Sure.
So they could, you know, these are families. You've got to be honest with you, separation changes you. The war and combat, you know, has changed these people significantly. I mean, it's just, you don't go through those experiences and not become a changed person. And so I thought it was, you know, the focus was on making sure that our families got everything they needed. You know, the problem is that costs money. And of course, you know, a lot of people felt that the services should have paid for that. They weren't resourced or funded for that. And, you know, again, SOCOM put it at a much higher priority than the services did. It came a pretty contentious there in the Admiral McRaven's days. But, you know, if you know Admiral Bill McRaven, it's, you know, he's not a man that's going to blink and take stock of his fears. He just doesn't do that. He believed it was the right thing, and he pressed ahead. And, I mean, I think they've come a long, long way. I mean, the preservation of the force and family thing over the last 6 years has really chipped away at a lot of the issues. And I don't think it's perfect by any means. I think it needs to be fully funded. I mean, I think it needs to go beyond the operators and to all the support personnel. I don't think there's anybody in our tactical formations that should not be privileged to have that level of support. So okay. That's kind of where we are in that.
All right. And I guess the public became aware that there are spouses and families after the Niger incident. And that's been picked over and pulled apart, and probably all the analysis is still not done yet. That's going to take place in the fullness of time. But as a longtime operator and observer of this from the outside, what do you think the lessons learned are going to be there?
I mean, we've been bearing guys I mean, we do it every year, almost every month. I mean, we lose a lot of people in training. A lot of the training we have is high-risk training. So, you know, the one thing Special Operations does, I think, exceptionally well is we honor our dead, our fallen. I mean, that is not something that we take lightly.
But I was wondering if you felt there were leadership or tactical or deployment lessons that
you know, I don't know. I've been in enough gunfights. I don't ever second guess anybody in any of those things. I wasn't there. If you lined up every single person that's out there, you'll get a different story from every single one of them. That's why these investigations are so darn hard and take so long. And, you know, every time I see one, I thank God I'm not the guy having to be the investigating officer on something like that. I mean, so I don't really try to second guess folks. Were there mistakes? Probably. You know, did anyone do anything meaningful? No, absolutely not. I mean, those guys fought like warriors. And so that is the part that we all respect and honor. I have trust and confidence that the leaders will do the right thing. If they don't, you know, then shame on them. But I think they're going to do the right thing.
You're listening to my interview with Stu Braden, president and CEO of the Global Soft Foundation. More after this short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Leidos is proud to support U.S. SOCOM and its mission to protect America's interests around the world. SOCOM's can't-fail missions can't afford anything less than the latest cutting-edge technology. That's why at Leidos, we develop adaptive and agile solutions, utilizing open systems architecture that rapidly integrates new innovations, ensuring special operations forces have the decisive advantage on the battlefield. At Leidos, we're helping SOCOM achieve mission success today and transform mission readiness for tomorrow. To learn more, visit leidos.com.
Welcome back to this final segment of my interview with Stu Braden, president and CEO of the Global Soft Foundation. Here, Braden talks about the S in Special Operations.
Special Operations sends people into harm's way every single day. And we often send them out there with, you know, less than adequate resources. That's why the first word is special in Special Operations. And so, you know, we don't want bad things to happen to them, but often it does. And I just see, you know, I see our people. That's why we put so much emphasis on our people, our training and stuff. That's why it matters to us.
And I guess apropos of the noise outside, you've got some recommendations for aviation. That's kind of a narrow area for you to focus on with respect to the other strategic training support to operations.
So, you know, when I came into Special Ops in the mid-80s, you know, everything was infiltration by foot. You were stealthy, sneaky. This was prior to precision weapons. This was prior to proliferation of night vision devices and thermal devices and FLIRs. And, you know, basically technology has made, you know, walking on the ground very dangerous. You know, it's slow, it's methodical. You can still do it, but you can't do it in mass or quantity, not like you did in the old days. And so, you know, we have developed our land forces, Special Ops, and our maritime forces quite well. If you look across most of the countries out there, they've got quality folks. What's lacking is air, and what we call the enablers, you know, the C4ISR piece, that's what they don't have, you know, because that's expensive. Anytime you're dealing with communications and aviation, there's a lot of zeros on those checks you write. And if you want to be world class, I mean, you're asking people to fly into harm's way in really bad weather at night into some really bad locations on maps. And it takes special people to do that. The stress on those guys is ridiculous. And so what we're trying to do is, we think it's the age of aviation, you know, and you can see it everywhere out there. Most nations are starting to spend more and more money on their rotary wing mainly, and trying to grow that out. And if not make them special operations, give them a habitual relationship with their special operations, which is an okay starting point at some point. You know, we prefer them to be assigned to the special operations so they're a little bit closer than cousins.
But the idea of a small footprint, low-cost, multi-role aircraft that you're calling for, does that exist now? I mean, there's a model being demonstrated during the SOFIC conference sitting out there.
Yeah, and so, well,
nondescript.
There's several of them. You know, the first time I was exposed to them, I was a captain, and I was in the U.S. Embassy in La Paz, Bolivia in 1993, and they had Super Tucanos, and the Bolivians had 8 or 9 of them, and that's the first time I'd ever seen one. My father was an Army aviator, flew caribous and helicopters, and so I kind of have a little bit of understanding of aviation and stuff, and so we use those types of platforms in Vietnam well. and we actually used them in Korea. Well, we got away from them for a while because we thought we were going to be fighting the 8th Guard Shock Army coming out of Magdeburg across the North German plains. So we got rid of those low, slow, loitering ordnance platforms, and we went to faster, more maneuverable fighters and stuff. And so, unfortunately, we've been bogged down in these operations for the last 35, 40 years that require low and slow and people that have significant loiter time.
It sounds like maybe this is where the drones could come in.
I mean, there's a thousand different ways to do this and stuff, you know. And so, I mean, the biggest change has been the fact that these drones can loiter, they can spend time. That's good. And it's really nice to send autonomous things into places that you're really not sure of, because if they get shot down, there's no loss of life. It's just loss of resource. And so that is good. But there's, you know, I know there's a lot of talk inside the Air Force to do this. That's good. That's a good discussion to have. You know, can it support special operations? I mean, I know that there's been a few programs inside the special operations community where we want these types of platforms. We like them. There's no one size fits all. And so that's expensive, but it's extremely effective. And so I think it's absolutely worth considering. I think, you know, that it's ultimately at some point in time, we're going to do it. And so what we do, I don't know, you know, but I know ultimately the operational environment's going to demand it.
And looking at the very big picture, all of the people in special operations from whatever armed services they derive from ultimately come from the United States. And, you know, culturally and educationally, the country's changing quite a bit. And so the question is, where do you think we're going to grow these types of people? Not that they are ready to enter special operations, but that have the attitude, background, and desire to say, maybe I could do this in the first place.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, from my understanding, we are struggling right now in getting people to join. And it's not because of the war or anything. It's just people are, you know, I have three kids. I have three girls, 22, 20, and 17. And, you know, that's a different generation. They think differently. They act differently. They're not dumb, you know. They're not geniuses either, by the way, you know, any stretch of the imaginations. But they are different, you know. They're generationally and stuff. And so, I think we're going to have to change and evolve with it. Historically, we've done that. Historically, we've done those kind of things where we've evolved with the force. But I think we're going to have to be a little bit smarter about this in the future and stuff. And we just, you know, education, like you see the CAPEX demonstration, capabilities demonstration outside. Those little things like that go a long way of getting people to join the military and to be a part of it. We used to, when I was a kid growing up, we'd have military days and you would go there and they'd fly in helicopters, families, you know. And you couldn't do that now if you wanted to. I mean, it would just never happen.
The lawyers would never let you do it.
No, you'd be in Fort Leavenworth before the day was out. And so, but I mean, you know, a lot of people join. It's, I think like 80% of the, you know, the people who have children in the military, they join the military. And so I'm not, I think that's not a good thing. But I think it's something that is, I think if the more we can do to advertise and to educate the young people, the better. I think they'll want to do it. I mean, they like doing these things, you know, the X Games. They like doing all these crazy things. Well, Lord, man, you come into Special Forces and they'll pay you to do it. They'll let you do it every day if you want to.
Well, yeah, I mean, toys are good. The situations are interesting. But the reality is that physically it's hugely difficult.
Yes,
and
it's a hard way
mentally,
to make a living.
Mentally, it's really difficult. I mean, you know, what do they say? 90% is mental and the other 90% is physical. I guess the question is, do you enjoy that kind of life?
I loved it. I mean, I got every job I wanted except one. Every assignment except one. So it's kind of hard to complain about that.
You've been listening to an interview with Stu Braden, President and CEO of the Global Soft Foundation, Special Operations Forces. You can hear this interview on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus, SOCOM. Sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.